On Sunday, November 26th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will recognize the start of the African Diaspora International Film Festival with Barbara McCullough, director of Horace Tapscott, musical Griot. We will also speak to Stephen Izuarati, author of The Dark Tree, Jazz and the Community Arts in Los Angeles, and multi-instrumentalist Sabir Mateen. That's Sunday, November 26th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
I want a little sugar in my bowl. I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh, so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. And our focus of this evening will be Horace Tapscott. We're going to start off the program with a documentary featured at the African Diaspora International Film Festival from filmmaker, educator, renowned international artist, director of Horace Tapscott Musical Griot, Barbara McCullough. The film will be screening at the festival on Saturday, December 2nd at 3 p.m. More information will be given during our On the Bandstand segment from our associate producer, Hank Williams. Stay tuned. We're going to open up the program with a song titled Niger's Theme. This is a Horace Tapscott composition from the Horace Tapscott Quintet, and the release is The Giant is Awakened. And we at Sugar in My Bowl would like to send condolences to the Conline family. Bill Conline, who was actively involved with the Brecht Forum, has made his transition. Bill was also a huge Sugar fan. We would often talk about music, the program, and varying other matters of social justice. Bill Conline will be missed. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, starting now.
I want some sugar in my bowl. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Barbara McCullough.
Barbara McCullough, thank you for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Yes, and thank you so much for your inquiry about my film Horse Cat Scott Musical Griot.
And Barbara McCullough is a filmmaker, educator, and renowned international artist, and the director of Horace Tapscott Musical Griot. First off, from having seen the film, a lot of the footage comes from 1991. How did you get your hands on it?
Everything that you see in terms of any kind of live footage was all what I actually filmed. So it started in about 1977, 1978, and it went on in the 80s, and it went on up until 1991, when I filmed his first performance at the Village Vanguard in New York. It was actually 16mm film that was then transferred digital files to be edited in HD for Blu-ray and DVD. So it's archival footage, yes, but it's everything that I shot.
Okay, I suspected that. Were you also the woman off camera who was asking questions?
Yes, I was. Actually, I wanted to, basically not be off camera asking questions because I wanted Horace to tell his story, but I needed to basically get a few things because Horace is a wonderful person. Spirituality basically, pervades music, and I just wanted to make sure we touched on some things that could bring that out.
How did you wind up doing this, recording him, videotaping him, following him?
Horace had been around for a very long time, and I didn't really know him personally, but I knew a lot of artists who did know him. And there was a film done a while back by Larry Clark, a filmmaker in Los Angeles, called Passing Through, and was loosely based on the life of Horace Tapscott, and actually he was in the film. And one of the things that it touched on is how difficult it was for creative artists to control their music, and actually how difficult it was dealing with powers that be that dictated who could or could not record. So it was a film that had been done, and I had not actually seen the film until a film festival I went to in Italy, and somebody asked me, why did I decide to do the film? And it's like nobody else had recorded Horace, and he had had an aneurysm, and it's like, how could no one have recorded him,
Wow.
Because he was really such an important, iconic figure in the Los Angeles jazz community.
I noticed one of the interviewers, I guess that was at the Village Vanguard, was Greg Tate.
Arthur Jaffa was supposed to, come and participate, but he had other work at the time. So I was fortunate enough that Greg, sort of subbed in and came and asked some very important questions of Horace. But Horace was a storyteller. He was a mentor to several generations of musicians. He was an activist. His music was blacklisted from radio stations. Basically, because of his political affiliations, the powers that be were not interested, basically, in having his political activism as manifested through his music exposed to a larger audience.
I discovered that he was also involved in the production of Elaine Brown's Seize the Time release. He was the arranger and also played piano.
Yes. I really wanted to basically let Horace tell his story and let him bring out that he thought were important, which I think he was pretty successful in doing. I wanted to give him an open forum to basically talk about stuff. And so every now and then he would say to me, well, you know what? I'm going to be doing this, or I'm going to be doing that, or you might want to come, And so it was like a collaboration, but also at the same time, so I was taking his lead, but also trying to really find out and reveal who he was as a creative artist.
Well, it's definitely something I appreciated from your film. You start from the beginning, from his days of just learning how to play, from when he played trombone, which I wasn't aware of, and just what led him on his musical journey and what led him to sharing the information, what he learned musically with other people, with many other people.
Exactly.
Someone else that was filmed was The Remembrances of Trumpeter Don Cherry.
That was a long time ago, but yeah, I was friends with Don at the time. And, Horace and I were talking, and we said, well, maybe we should get Mr. Brown and Horace and Don together to talk about some of those experiences. And it was very revealing. Don was very forthcoming in terms of his difficulty early on as a young man, and, how he got to meet Billy Higgins. So it wound up being archival because of the fact how old the footage was, and I was very lucky that it held up as much as it did, because we're talking about something that was like, over 30 years ago.
Right.
So I was really very scared for a long time. I mean, I didn't have the opportunity to just sit down and just edit the thing, okay? So I worked with my editor who visited him a couple of times in New York, because he and I were working together a long, long time ago in the very beginning of this project. But I was very, very afraid that I might have lost some of it because, it really took a lot of very delicate handling of it in order to not lose the footage before it was transferred to digital files.
Who was the editor that was working with you?
Scott Brock. He lives in the New York area.
How did the opportunity present itself to where you could actually put it into the form that it is today?
For a while, the structure was like sort of evading me. I was Horace is a wonderful storyteller. You know, I had all these different pieces, you know, together. And what happened was he had done a presentation and a solo concert on a wonderful Libby grand piano for the Santa Barbara Jazz and World Music Society with one of, I guess, the next to last shoot that we had done. And at that time, you know, he was on a white tuxedo.
Right.
And he was essentially talking about his evolution as a musician, his inspiration in music, his mentors, people he played with, what have you. And so that wound up being a thread to put everything together that I already had. Plus, I decided to have music in the background and wound up really having me call it Horace Tapscott Musical Griot, griot meaning similar to a storyteller in West African societies who related the history of their group in story and also in musical form. So it just really worked out that, you know, he was standing in his white tuxedo without the tie. And basically, you know, talking to people who were not necessarily, who weren't of his community, but still he was giving that verbal accounting of where he came from and who his influences were. And it worked out for me.
Now, I noticed you also included some dialogue from Black Arthur Blythe. Do you want to talk about how that wound up happening?
Yeah, Arthur was playing with Horace. The beginning of that segment was done at the Marvelous Memory Lane, and there is a banner on the front of a club saying who was going to be there that weekend. And so Arthur was in town, and he wasn't a frequent visitor to town in those days. So it just kind of like made sense. Through Horace's help, we got a chance to go there at 4 o'clock in the morning because everybody was really seriously tired to let them talk. Let them talk about their experience, you know, let them talk about things like their heritage and speaking about their heritage. Some people didn't necessarily get it that you don't have to be against someone in order to speak with pride about your heritage. And that was one of the things that came out in that particular segment. Also the fact that, you know, and both of them agree that, you know, this music is music meaning jazz in African-American classical music, which is what Horace called it. It is the one music that comes from this country. And he later says, why do musicians have to go to Europe in order to live in America? And that came about basically because Arthur just happened to be in town.
Now, there was one thing that Arthur Blythe did say, and you touched upon it, in that everybody else can have pride and nationalism, but as soon as we start talking about loving ourselves, it's talked about as hate. And
yes,
that was a very strong statement and very true.
Exactly. And this free-flowing conversation was really very special for me in terms of my experience as a filmmaker, recording all this and putting this together as one project because, you know, I had met Arthur before, so it wasn't like I hadn't had any knowledge of him or he having any awareness of me. So this is what made it kind of good. And also it helped out with the conversation with Don. And, you know, it was very special also for me to be in the presence of Mr. Samuel Brown because, you know, he was so well thought of and influenced so many people. He passed away, I think, about a year or two later. You know, but he was a marvelous man who was always about learning something new and sharing what he knew.
Now, was it Dr. Samuel Brown who made the comment to Horace Tapscott about teaching him if he teaches others?
Right. This is Horace's voice. He said, you know, Mr. Brown told him, I will give you this knowledge if you agree to share with others. And that's what he did. And that was Horace's commitment, which is part of the reason why he never left. I mean,
right.
Well, he did leave. He went to New York with Eric Dolphy, but he came back. Well, Eric stayed, but he came back. You know, and
right.
He says in the film, if you can't do it here, you can't do it anywhere else.
There's going to be a screening of this film as part of the African Diaspora International Film Festival here in New York on December 2nd, Saturday, December 2nd at 3 p.m. at Milbank
yes.
Chapel Teachers College as part of Columbia University. That's 525 West 20th Street. Are you going to be here for the Q&A?
No, unfortunately, I'm not going to be there.
Okay.
One of the things that's kind of nice about this film is that it has so many different cinematographers, and Al Santana, who is a New York filmmaker and
yes.
cinematographer, who shot this stuff at the Village Vanguard. He lives locally in New York.
Right.
Scott, who's the editor, he is pretty busy right now, so it's really going to be very difficult for anybody to be able to like make it and to speak of the film. But I do hope that I get a chance in the future to be there when the film is screened because I like to be there. I like to see the reaction of the audience and I like to entertain the audience's questions about not only the film but also my background too because I come from a family of traditional jazz musicians, what some people call Dixieland. My maiden name is Alcorn and my uncle Alvin was an internationally known Dixieland musician. And all my uncles and my father was secretary of the musicians union when it was the old segregated union. Even though he was blind, he was still doing that. And so that sort of like immersed me and my sister into the music, starting off with early, early rock and roll. You know, I'm talking about the Little Richard era.
Right.
And so because I was this child of this father who at times needed his kids to go with him places, this is how I got a chance to see some of the very early, early musicians, you know, playing, you know, or what people call rock and roll. So my background is really what lent me this whole interest in music in the first place and gave me a background and a foundation for appreciation of it.
Were you involved in the Limerick Park Arts movement?
Not really. I mean, I used to work with David Unnecherry, you know, for, you know, a few years, you know, and I would kind of like help him book and manage, you know, for a while. But essentially, you know, Limerick Park is one of those things that you participate by way of your attending the different things that go on there.
Right.
Like the World Stage. Okay, and then around the corner from that was Ben Caldwell's Chaos Gallery. And basically that was where he taught young people and engaged young people in understanding video production primarily. And also it was a seminal place for exposing hip-hop artists.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you have these two different things. You have jazz, creative jazz, and then around the corner you had hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole Limerick area is, you know, was really one that was very vital, and actually it still is, too. Ben Caldwell is still there. I think Warren
right.
Bradford, who's a well-known artist, he has a place there. The World Stage has moved, but it's still there. There's a long-term person who's been there, Tika, who used to do jewelry, now self-clothes. So it's like it's a vital community that a lot of times you wonder if it can maintain because gentrification has come in.
Right.
You know, people want to change it, just like everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
People want to change it and make it into franchises, but hopefully it can hold on and keep that vibe. There used to be a gallery there called Brockman Gallery, which
yes.
is not there anymore. But it's kind of a historical art community within the African-American community.
Right. There's some other footage that you recorded from the Watts Tower Jazz Festival. It was around the 1980s.
Yes.
That was really wonderful to see.
That was one of my early shoots. And you see young people in there, you know, they basically have gone on to be, you know, well-known musicians. They just showed the horse's evolution with young people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And one of the things that's kind of interesting is that I don't really know him, but when I screened the film for the very first time, Kamasi Washington was there. There's also an interview somewhere online with myself and other musicians who are part of Horace's orchestra. But what was so cool about it was he is like a direct line.
Yes.
You know, and he acknowledged that he always had heard of Horace, but he never actually had seen him.
Mm-hmm.
And had never seen him perform or, you know, see him play. And so that was really wonderful to me because I consider him, whether he had direct contact with Horace, he knew Horace's reputation. And basically, when you look at this large ensemble that he performs with, it's really pretty amazing. Just
yes.
I see it through part of that lineage.
Kamasi Washington has mentioned how he has been inspired by and has he's been in Limerick Park, goes there often. He's been there.
Oh, yeah.
And performed.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, unfortunately, he was getting back from Europe on a tour he had gone to during the summer, and so I missed his performance there, but he was late leaving, and then by the time I was at home, apparently he was there, gotten back from the airport, and he was there, but I have not ever seen him perform in person, only on the internet.
Oh, wonderful. So is there anything else you'd like to tell the WBAI listening audience about Horace Tapp Scott, musical griot?
Well, you know, of course, he's a very special person, and I still speak of him in the present because that's the way I see him.
Mm-hmm.
And I just hope that by seeing this film, folks get a real understanding of the importance of supporting musicians, you know, and the fact that not everyone gets the opportunity to record and record their own music. And Horace, basically, there was a poem that was recited, you know, at his memorial by Kamal Daoud, and the gist of it was, you know, my name is Horace Tapscott, and I did not sell out.
Mm-hmm.
So his integrity to the end was always there.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much, Barbara McCullough, for making this film and gifting it to the rest of the world.
Tell me that the sun belongs to you and should surround you. But when I turn to look, I see they've snatched the sun from all around you. Why you hardly seem to want what's yours. You hardly seem to care. If you love the sun where you come from, then you had better dare to seize the time. The time is now. Oh, see. because you've been denied. Well, I think that you're mistaken, or then you must have lied. Because you do not act like those who care. You've never even fought for the liberty that you claim to lack, or have you never fought?
Hi, my name is Joyce Jones, and I am here with, on the phone we have...
Stephen Zwarty.
Stephen Zwarty is the author of a couple of books. One in particular, The Dark Tree, Jazz and the Community Arts in Los Angeles. And that's pretty much the focus of why I have Stephen Zwarty on the line right now. Which way did it go? You worked on the Songs of the Unsung, the musical and social journey of Horace Tapscott first, and then you did The Dark Tree?
Yeah, actually there was an earlier collaboration with Horace on a book called Central Avenue Sounds. That kind of started our relationship. And then he, one night, we were celebrating, I think it was his 63rd birthday, and he and Celia, his wife, asked me if I'd like to write his book, his autobiography. And after I picked myself up, I was so thrilled. I agreed immediately, and so we did the autobiography first, and as we were finishing that, at our last taping session, Horace was talking about other things that need to be done in documenting the history of the community. He had a way of getting you to do more, and as I'm sure Sabir knows.
Yes.
So the thing that I wanted to do the most was tell the larger story of the orchestra and UGMA, and I proposed that, and Horace said, yeah, well, that needs to be done too. And so we were going to start on that as soon as I'd finished the autobiography, and we did so, but he became sick about that time.
And in the studio, before we continue to really get into this juicy piece of history, is Sabir Mateen, composer, saxophonist. You play alto?
Alto, tenor, and the other that I don't own. I play them too.
You play...
Don't forget flute, piano,
exactly.
Clarinet.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Multi-instrumentalist.
Oh, yes.
Sabir Mateen. So, Stephen.
Yes.
Well, first off, let the people know who Horace Tapscott is.
Sure. I think Horace was one of the major figures in American culture in the 20th century, and he certainly was a major figure in Los Angeles and in his African-American community. He, in 1961, began an organization that ultimately became the Pan-African People's Orchestra, and the and UGMA, the Union of God's Musicians and Artists Ascension, and over a period of about 40 years, he provided a community movement to provide music and other services to his community, to improve his community, and some 300, by my count, estimate, 300 artists passed through his various organizations over that 40-year period, including Sabir.
And Sabir, how did you wind up a part of the Horace Tapscott community in Los Angeles?
Well, I mean, I knew about Horace since when I was a teenager in Philly, well, my very late teens, really. You know, when I bought Leon Thomas's record, Spirits Known and Unknown.
Right.
And he mentioned Horace, Linda Hill, and Lester Robinson. Then I also had heard of him through records, and I bought Elaine Brown's record, and also reading Black Panther newspapers. Now, how I got into it was I was going to college out there in L.A. or Torrance, wherever that college is, El Camino. And I was also going to school with one of the members of the orchestra, K.P. Roberts. And we used to hang out and stuff. And, he was telling me who he was playing with, and I told him I'd heard of Horace, this and that and this, and that was... playing with this drummer whose name happened to be James Brown. Not the James Brown.
Oh. Yeah, okay.
But he changed his name to J.E. to kill the distinction. But we went and saw the band at the church that they were playing. The band played at many churches, but this was the famous last Sunday of the month concerts where the double LP, Live at IUCC, was recorded.
Now, IUCC stands for... Stephen?
Maybe you can help me.
The Emmanuel United Church of Christ.
There you go. I'd seen the band, they appeared at El Camino. Harris didn't come. He sent Jesse Sharps and Aubrey Hart, a couple other members, Ishmael Shabaka, and they sent them to the campus to play. So I seen them play. Then me and Jay went to the printing shop, and I told him, I said, I'm going to be in that band. I don't know how, when, or what, but I'm going to be in that band. Watch and see. And it happened sooner than I thought it was. Kayfee called me on the phone, and he says, Bear, we need a tenor player because they were going through some problems with the band, and they lost a lot of musicians, a lot of musicians out. And I said, well, I can't read so good. I seen you cats, and you cats are, man, great, you know. You know, he said, man, don't worry, just come on down, you know. I met Jesse in the park. You know, he heard me play, and Aubrey and KP was pushing hard to get me in. And, you know, just said, hey, man, I need a tenor player. I don't care. You know? So I got down there, you know. And no, it was an experience, because my thing with Horace is I was expecting totally so-called avant-garde, you know. Mm-hmm. And I got there. It was like a school. Rehearsals was like a school.
How so?
Well, when I got over there, we was playing stuff like B-Vamp, which is Book of Little's great masterpiece. Mm-hmm. McCoy Tyner's tune. I forget the name of the tune now, but it's ba-ba-da, ba-ba-ba-da, ba-da, da-da-da. I forget the name of the tune, but it was a great tune. We was playing some McCoy's tunes and Train stuff and Reincarnation of the Lovebird. These were one of the first tunes I played with them. It was just all standards. I ain't got to play one of the hardest tunes yet.
Huh.
But we did that, and you know, and it was interesting because I was searching for something different because I was just a cat. You know, I had a couple of teachers over going to college, you know, and
okay.
I was in music school in the neighborhood.
Okay.
You know, the classical guy. KP went to this guy, too. I didn't know about Mr. Julius. I forget his last name. But I actually studied clarinet with him. But I played, you know, saxophone with them and the college band. It was a good learning experience, you know, because, you know, of the things that Horace encouraged us to do, which was write. And I always wanted to write music, you know. So he encouraged us to write music and, you know,
tell me,
for ourselves.
Well, you told me you weren't too thrilled about the songs that you worked on at that time. Was it because...
About my songs.
Yeah.
Not their songs, my songs.
Right.
It wasn't my songs, it was my playing, because I was still developing.
Okay.
I mean, they tell me today that I have my own sound even now, but I thought I needed work. You know, but I was talking to... because I keep regular contact now with the orchestra. I talked to Kayfee Alvin because we're very close. And I'll be hard because we're very close.
Okay.
You know.
Thank you.
and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl's name of this program. What you're listening to in the background is Village Dance. This is a Sabir Mateen composition from Horace Tapscott with the Pan-African People's Orchestra. Live at IUCC, that's the Emmanuel Unit Church of Christ in Los Angeles, 1979, Nimbus West Records release. Horace Tapscott on piano, Sabir Mateen on tenor saxophone, John Williams on baritone saxophone, Billy Harris, soprano saxophone, Lester Robinson, trombone, Adele Sebastian, flute, Aubrey Hart, also on flute, Alan Hines, bass, and Roberto Miranda on bass as well. Daoud Woods on percussion and Billy Hinton on drums. Before that, we heard Elaine Brown's Seize the Time, the title track from the 1969 Vault release. Horace Tapscott was the arranger and played piano on this recording. Before that, as mentioned, we heard Niger's Theme, that's a Horace Tapscott composition, from the Horace Tapscott Quintet. The release is titled The Giant is Awakened, a 1969 Flying Dutchman release. Horace Tapscott on piano, Black Arthur Blythe on alto saxophone, David Bryant on bass, Walter Savage Jr. on bass, and Everett Brown Jr. on drums. And before that, we opened our program with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, from a compilation, The Very Best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. This is a RCA BMG release, originally recorded in 1967. The compilation was released in 1998. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams, and many thanks to the director of Horace Tapscott, musical griot, Barbara McCullough. Many thanks to Barbara McCullough. Stay tuned. Sugar in My Bowl continues with more from multi-instrumentalist Sabir Mateen and Stephen Isuardi, author of The Dark Tree, Jazz and the Community Arts in Los Angeles. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for November 26th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And this week's show features Barbara McCullough, director of the documentary film Horace Tapscott Musical Griot. The film will be screening on December 2nd at the Chapel of Columbia University's Teachers College as part of the African Diaspora International Film Festival. And we have many more listings for you this week, so let's get started. First, saxophonist Gary Bartz is at the Blue Note on November 27th with McCoy Tyner. Drummer and percussionist Bobby Sanabria leads the Multiverse Big Band in West Side Story at 60 Reimagined. And that's at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club from November 27th through 29th. Pianist Mark Carey is at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem on the 28th, playing the music of Duke Ellington. Bassist Christian McBride leads the Tip City Trio at the Village Vanguard from the 28th through December 3rd, and returns with Inside Straight from December 5th through 10th. Guitarist Mark Rebo is at Brooklyn's National Sawdust on December 1st for a 50th anniversary concert of John Coltrane's Interstellar Space, and he'll be at the Stone on December 6th with Ned Rothenberg. Drummer Lenny White is at Smoke with Buster Williams' quartet from December 1st through 3rd. He'll also be at Jazz at Lincoln Center with Rini Rosnes from the 7th through the 10th. Flutist Bobby Humphrey is at Harlem's Ginny Supper Club on the 2nd. Pianist and vocalist Amina Claudine Myers is at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem on the 5th for a talk about her career. Vision Fest promoters Arts for Art has a salon with saxophonist James Brandon Lewis and poet Quincy Troop in conversation and performance at the Lower East Side's Clemente Soto Velez Center on the 6th. Emma Franz's documentary film Bill Frisell, A Portrait starts a run at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village on the 6th. Pianist Randy Weston is at the New School for a screening and discussion of the documentary film Randy and Tangier on the 6th. He'll also be performing at the Chapel of Columbia University's Teachers College on the 10th, and that's to close out the African Diaspora International Film Festival. Guitarist Bill Frisell has a run at the Jazz Standard from the 7th through the 10th. Bassist William Parker is at Clemente Soto Velez Center on the 8th, and that's part of Arts for Arts' month-long Justice's Compassion Festival. Saxophonist Renee McLean is at City Lore's Lower East Side Gallery for a pre-Kwanzaa event on December 10th. Finally, saxophonist Gary Bartz and drummer Lenny White are at Smoke for a John Coltrane tribute from December 14th through 17th. That's all for this week. If you missed missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. If you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. See the support WBAI link on our website for details, and we're grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off. With our bi-weekly schedule, we're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on Sunday, December 10th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
So you got the thumbs up from Horace to join the band, huh? Or people just sort of come and go, like...
I forgot what happened, with, you know, but I just know Horace appeared at rehearsal and didn't say much, say too much anything. You know, he would just, if he wanted me to do this, he would tell me.
Yeah.
He actually helped me in... really developing of who I am, him and Jesse Sharps.
Okay.
Yeah, when he came to visit me in Philly a few years back, I told him, I said, look, man, you're just as much of my mentor as Horace.
Wow.
You know, and it's really interesting to have two great mentors in one band, especially a mentor who's younger than you.
You know? Sabir, when Jesse left, didn't you take over as band leader?
Well, if that's what you want to call it, yes. Well, you see, because I was surprised because I didn't know nothing about that stuff, you know. But there was also a lot of things that really the band, like, disappeared for a minute, you know. And then I got involved in some other things. Yeah, you might say that, you know. You know, I knew nothing about being a leader. Mm. But, you know... Horace had faith in me that I didn't have in myself. You know, I told Jesse that. He said, well, that's the type of person Horace is. Yeah. He can see you before you see yourself. And when I made Divine Mad Love, I called Horace up right away, you know. And it was on Thanksgiving that same year, and he died, a couple months after. But he got up after I made a recording, he goes, yeah. I knew you would do it. He said, I knew you could do it. I always knew you could do it.
Wow.
He said, you're going to keep it up. He was already happy that I was working with Wilbur. I worked in Wilbur Morris's last band.
So, Stephen, tell me about the community at the time in the 60s. What was going on that opened up things for Horace Tapscott?
Well, Horace made a conscious decision to change his life. Mm-hmm. To change his career direction. And it was a decision that led him from the ranks of becoming a professional musician, if you want to call it that, or a more commercially oriented one. He was a young man in his mid-20s. He was playing in Lionel Hampton's band,
right.
And he was playing trombone, but he was also sitting in on piano at times. He was doing some arranging. I mean, you know, he was on the up escalator in the music world, and he walked away from all that in early 1961 because he was disillusioned with commerce. He was disillusioned with the way he saw the community going. Having grown up in the Central Avenue days, which to him was a nurturing center, he saw all of that being eliminated, disappearing from the community, and he thought, you know, that he could make a difference. And so he commits himself. He walks away from that Hampton gig and a number of months later commits himself to building initially a community band that could be a force that would move music and the arts into everyday community life in the hope of raising the cultural and social level of community, becoming a force for change. And he commits himself to that by the end of 61, early 1962. And from that point on, that's the rest of his life. It was a bold decision. He really did turn his back on the outside world almost in a sense. And from that point, the movement grows. What they were doing in the early 60s, the kind of things they stood for, were well in advance of what other people were doing, challenging police brutality, bringing music any way they could to people's attention in the community, encouraging musicians to write music that reflected the needs and concerns of the community, and taking every opportunity to play. You didn't wait for a gig. You went out and played on a street corner. You went out and played in a park. You went into the schools. And you also recruited people to play that way. By the mid-late 60s, that kind of ethos is, of course, spreading much more within the community, and particularly after the upheavals of 65 in South Central LA.
Mm-hmm.
People have, initially, after the upheavals, people certainly had a need to communicate, to talk, to sort out what had happened. And this was before the political movements had really emerged. The Panthers don't really begin till 66, come into LA shortly after. But initially, it's through movements like UGMA. Back then, they were UGMA, the Underground Musicians Association. It was through them, it was through the poets, through a lot of the visual artists who were immediately trying to process and express what was happening. And as that happened, what UGMA had been doing for a few years started spreading in a sense. They started meeting more people, and there were more areas that were being given over to that kind of work within the community. And, of course, UGMA started growing then as well.
you mentioned the visual artists and the poets. What was the role of Marla Gibbs, who is famously known as Flo on the Jeffersons?
Oh, geez. Marla's role has been huge within the community. She comes to L.A. from Chicago in, I think it's the later 60s, and she's a single mother. She's got kids. She's holding down a job, I think, out at the airport, but she's also participating in the community arts movement in Watts. She's going to acting classes at the Mufundi Institute and things like that, and it's during this time that she also meets Horace and discovers what the orchestra is about and what UGMA is trying to do. And she gets involved in that initially as a vocalist. But within a couple of years, she plays an important role in helping institutionalize the organization, getting nonprofit status. And of course, with her success on television, she can put some money behind a lot of other activities within the community. And she continued to do that up through the 90s. Where she put her money where her mouth was in Leimert Park and helped establish a vision cultural complex, which grew out of her earlier Crossroads Cultural School. For decades, Marla's been a force for the arts.
Now, tell us about Limerick Park.
Well, in general, Limerick Park began in the late 20s, early 30s as a planned community. It was a planned community for working and middle-class people. And, of course, back then, L.A. was segregated de jure, and they did it through property, through restrictive covenants and property deeds. That starts changing with the Shelley versus Kramer Supreme Court decision in 48, and African-Americans start moving away from Central Avenue into other areas, including Limerick Park. By the mid-60s, Limerick Park is one of the centers, and that part of L.A. along Crenshaw Boulevard is one of the centers of the African-American community. And in 1967, two brothers, Dale and Alonzo Davis, opened the Brockman Gallery in Limerick Park, and that is the first gallery to feature visual art by African-Americans and others as well. The Brockman Gallery also starts sponsoring performances in Limerick Park. It's basically, physically, it's a couple of block area with a lot of small shops, and artists start moving into the area, and that continues into the 80s. And in 1989, Kamau Daoud, Billy Higgins established the World Stage Performance Gallery. A couple of other spaces open up. And especially after the upheavals in 92, Limerick Park becomes really the center of the African-American community arts movement, just as 103rd Street in Watts was the center during the 1960s and early 70s. And it continues to this day. It has taken some blows because of the passing of a number of very important figures like Billy Higgins and Horace Tapscott. Mm. And Richard Fulton, the owner of Fifth Street Dick's, which was a marvelous performance space down there. But it's also taken hits from rising real estate, which has forced some artists out. But it still does carry on as a major area, including a number of spaces for the African-American community arts.
Now, is there anything in Los Angeles presently that matches the orchestra and Horace Tapscott's musical work?
No, I don't think so. I don't think there ever was. There are other musical aggregations. There's Jesse Sharps actually did do an album with a number of musicians from the orchestra as well as from others in L.A. They put together a group called The Gathering, and they did a CD, which in a lot of ways is comes out of the Arc. There is another organization around called To Build an Arc that Carlos Nino and Miguel Atwood Ferguson started 10 years ago, and that initially included a number of Arc members. But none of these aggregations are what Horace led and what Sabir and all these artists built over many years, I think, was unique because of the extent of their involvement in the community, their commitment, wide range of things, not musical, social, cultural, nothing quite like it.
Well, Sabir, you were telling me that the organization that Horace Tapscott and you and your buddies put together existed before the AACM. Is that correct?
UGMA is the forerunner of all the other organizations. Steve said, we came together in 1961. I was 10 years old, but we came together. I just know when I came in that everything is simultaneous, you know. The ARC, as we commonly call it, nickname. And I was a member of UGMA, and didn't know too much about all that, you know, because I was mainly concentrating on the music. You know, I just knew they both went hand in hand. Because when I came in the late 70s.
Okay.
Yeah, and stayed to the beginning of the 80s, close to 5 years. And I left Los Angeles because my mother passed, so I left. But it was almost like, you know, playing, joining AACM or playing with Sunrise. Once you're in, you're in.
Yeah.
You know? We're still members of the orchestra.
Right.
You know, the few of us are in New York. We're scattered all over the world. It's you, you know. You know, you are UGMA, you're a part of the organization. In fact, my first gig with the orchestra was a play.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What kind of play?
Play about King Christophe. He was one of the kings of Haitian back in the 18th century. You know, it was interesting. It was with the orchestra starring William Marshall and Marley Gibbs. I can never remember his name, but he played Rollo in Sanford and Son.
I had read that William Marshall was involved in the group.
Oh,
and
yeah.
he played Blackula.
Yes.
Among other things.
Well, his first TV scene was Bonanza. But anyway.
Yes, yes.
I was really surprised to see him on there, you know. You know, but
It was true. There weren't too many black people on Bonanza.
No. Well, the character Adam was responsible for that. I read his history, and he used to argue with the producers to put minorities on that show.
Oh, okay.
Marla was really involved because, you know, she started to open up in the print shop a thing for actors and actresses. Mm-hmm. You know, because I used to work for Marla, too. I was a cleanup guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I cleaned
the cleanup
up the place.
Guy.
Yeah. Well, these days they call them janitors.
Okay.
You know, you even go to school to be a janitor these days. So it was like our thing was to preserve the music. It was really something to me about Horace's thing about keeping the music in the community. That's something that is lacking in a lot of cities, especially here in New York.
Right.
You know, because in Philly, even, there's a lot of music that's in the community, you know. Nowadays, almost everything is out of the community, almost everywhere. But when I was in Philly in the 80s, which I met my pianist, you know, Raymond King, who also had a close association with Horace.
And he's a visual artist as well.
Yes. This is how we hooked up was the fact that we both knew Horace. When I told Horace I was playing with Raymond, he was very happy. You know? Yeah, he said, keep playing with Raymond.
Wow.
Yeah, and to this day, this is what we've done. And Raymond's 83. He doesn't look older than 60, but he's 83.
No, he doesn't.
Yes. Do you have any of his carbon images?
I do. I did. I got one when they did the tribute to Billy Bang at the Vision Festival.
Yeah. Yes, because he showed me photos when he used to hang, when he was around Linda Hill and Lester Robinson and all of them. They used to do his shows, too.
Thank you.
Tell me about Linda Hill, Stephen.
Well, if Horace was the patriarch, Linda was the matriarch. Okay. She was, for maybe the first 20 years of the organization's existence, Linda was one of the key figures in the organization up till the maybe late 70s, early 80s. She was the cement. During that period, usually there was a house that was the focal point for the organization. And more often than not, it was where Linda was living. And they became known as UGMA houses. And she was the one who kind of, in a way, held it together, provided a central space. She, along with Horace, very early on, before really anybody else was into African, West African in particular culture. She was into a lot of alternative things in terms of dress, lifestyle, etc., well before anybody else was. And she also was a remarkable musician. This is someone who did have music in her family background, who did have some training in school, but really, when she was in her 20s and came around Horace, in no time mastered a number of instruments, was writing music, was writing lyrics, was vocalizing. Really quite extraordinary. A lot of the members from back then have told me that they remember seeing her in a rehearsal playing, you know, three, four different instruments, moving from one to another.
Wow.
She was really an extraordinary person. And she was a force also for pulling the arts together, making the organization, something that Horace is in sympathy with as well, kind of a forum, not just for music, but also pulling in the other arts, making dance a part of it, making the visual arts a part of it. She was very supportive of that. She wrote poetry. I think she was quite remarkable, and she also, just the force of her example, I think, was very important in the early history of the organization, especially during that time, because so many of the men had to start thinking differently about women after meeting Linda and interacting with Linda.
Sabir, did you start to think and act differently as a result of meeting Linda?
Oh, yes. Musically, spiritually, mm-hmm. And I also lived in Linda's home with her and her husband, so I shared a lot of time with Linda, even after orchestra rehearsals and things like that. And I was very fortunate to be on her first recording.
Oh.
Yes, Lullaby with Linda. I don't understand why I never made the CD, but it was a great recording. And well, she was great. As she said, she was very, very influential. Mm. You know, dancing, you know. She helped me even craft my voice. She taught me how to yodel.
Oh.
Well, Leon taught her how to yodel.
I was just thinking of Leon. Okay.
Well, he's an orchestra member, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
When Pharaoh used to come to L.A., he used to use a lot of orchestra members.
Wow.
And Gates is sitting with him. And in fact, I was talking to him recently. He mentored quite a few guys because he always loved Horace. But playing with that group means a whole lot, not just in the musical community, but in the cultural community and in the political community, mm-hmm. and other things, you know. It's in the book, you know, I told Steve about it in the book, the incident I had with the gang members. You know?
Oh, what was the incident that you had with the gang members?
And yeah, that's a good story, Sabir.
Well, actually, I was coming from another orchestra member's house, Ray Strada's house. And I've been there for about 3 or 4 days. Because he's an excellent incense maker.
Oh.
And taught me how to make incense, most of us.
Wow.
So I was coming from there, and I was just getting on the bus. So these guys would follow me on the bus. They wanted to, the word we used to use back in the day, they wanted to move on me.
Oh.
Yeah. The story, it gets dusty and dusty as I get younger and younger. But they got on the bus. The bus drivers, you know, we'll let them on. Mm-hmm. They were going on the bus and make the move. And somebody said, no. Leave him alone. He plays with that band down the street.
Oh.
You know. Okay. Music really does strange things to people because they actually have respect. The place I was just living in, I live next door to the drug kids, you know. Mm-hmm. You know. But when they see me, they call me sir and totally respect me, you know. We used to rehearse. They just stand there and listen to us.
Wow.
They did it in Philly. They did it everywhere I live. So music is a powerful force. And if you're a community-oriented musician, it means a lot. Because this is one thing Horace taught us, wherever we go, you know. And one of the members, Al Hines, wrote a song. This helps me in my travels. Because I found out traveling around the world, there's a black community all over the world.
Mm.
Everywhere you go. He wrote a tune called People Like Us. I don't know if you ever heard it, Steve, but
It's a beautiful piece. It's one of my favorites.
Yes.
What is that from?
Well, I don't
know.
Not
from anywhere.
Oh, it was never recorded?
We did record
it. Yeah, we have some, we know we've got performances of the orchestra, with the live performances with them doing it, but it's never been put out.
Okay.
It was written by Al Hines, the bass player.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's fabulous.
Oh, yeah. It's a great tune, you know. But Horace and Linda, they can write anything from swing to so-called moto to bebop and avant-garde. Horace wrote some avant-garde tunes and no one's even heard. You know.
Actually, that's something that a few people have wanted to get out in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
There was hope for a while that when Jesse Sharps and the Gathering got together that they might be able to record it, but it just hasn't happened yet.
Well, when I came home, you know, came back to Philly, Horace told me to go play with Sun Ra.
Oh.
But see, what happened was, well, I met Sun Ra in L.A. because he came to see us. But I missed a great concert of the meeting of the two orchestras.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was in the late 60s, early 70s. I don't know if you heard about that one, Steve.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Jenke even wrote a piece about Sun Ra. I've heard a lot of stories about that concert.
Oh, yeah, I did, too. And knowing both, I believe it, you know. I spent as many hours of summer almost as I did with Horace, you know. Except most of the summer I was on the telephone, or Horace was in person. I mean,
Will
he told
talked
me,
about that concert. He was in the band.
I know.
Now, Will was
Will Connell.
Yes.
Will Connell, yes.
That was the person you were talking about, Sabir, that did the copy?
He was a copyist, yes.
Okay.
And you know what really I found out? He wrote all the music for the Ark. We did this tribute to Horace about 15, 16 years ago, something like that, when they had it at the old knitting factory, right? And we did a tribute to Horace. Wilbur put a group with me, Will, Steve Swell, and Robert's Moment, right? Because we were trying to figure out how to do it, so we decided all three of us to play together. Then I saw the handwriting. And that's when it came to me that was real handwriting. We was always a copyist.
Now, what is a copyist? Just so, you know,
that's when
we all
you want your music to be legible, neat. You're a very neat writer.
Okay. And, and then you give it to the other musicians so they can read it?
And the band leader gives it to the other musicians.
Right.
You know, he's written stuff for David Murray and another orchestra member, Butch Mars.
Oh, yeah.
And he did the music for Skies of America with Ned Coleman's. And he gets around
Sounds
a lot.
A guy.
Now, we need to wrap up.
Mm.
Is there anything more, Stephen, that you would like to add about the Pan-African People's Orchestra or the Union of God's Musicians and Artists Ascension?
Oh, there's a lot more to add.
I know. That's exactly. And that's exactly what I was going to say. People really need to get the Dark Tree,
the
Jazz and the Community Arts in Los Angeles by Stephen L. Izzardi, Isoardi. Make sure you get it. It's, who published this? The University of California Press. Mm-hmm. It is an excellent documentation of that period. It's sort of one of three parts, I guess, with regard to Horace Tapscott, I guess.
Yeah, the thing that has impressed me is the book just, in a lot of ways, scratches the surface. The one thing I learned very quickly was how deep the movement was and how many branches there were of it. And that book really only focuses on the orchestra. I do go into other organizations to the extent that they interacted with the orchestra, and many did. But there were so many other movements, so many or other organizations and people involved that I think I'm still struck by the depth and the breadth of the movement in South Central, and there's no way one book could do it justice.
Oh, no.
It is a very, very deep well, and there's so much to be drawn out of it. And I hope that there is more work in the future to explore this, because I think the riches are so profound, and what Kelly has done is wonderful in exposing just part of it, but there's so much more.
Oh, God, there's a lot. We can sit here this time next year and still be talking about it.
Well, thank you, Stephen L. Izzardi. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Thanks. I just want to make sure.
Well, it, It's an Italian name, and the key is just pronounce each letter, and you got it. Isuardi.
Thank you, Isuardi.
Hey, I learned something today.
You know, it's like, I wanted to make sure I got this right.
Now, Sabir, you've been over in Italy. I've got one of your records from Rome.
So, actually, Stephen Isuardi, tell me about your role as a social studies faculty with the Oakwood School.
Well, I teach social studies, mm-hmm. and I've also taught for many years history of jazz. I've spent quite a bit of that time trying to involve my students, or at least make them aware, and to some extent have them involved with the community. One of my students ended up playing bass in the orchestra. A couple of them have spent a lot of time in Leimert Park, and that's been a source of a lot of satisfaction to me. So, I mean, Horace has influenced what I do in terms of teaching a lot. I've had a lot of the guys come to Oakwood to play. Michael Sessions' bands, Nate Morgan and his bands have come, you know, smaller units within the orchestra. So to me, teaching has always been a process of knocking down walls and getting students out into communities and bringing riches from communities into the classroom. I try and make a point of bringing artists like Bobby Bradford and the poet Kamau Daoud in to talk to students and share their work. So it's been very important to me. The irony in a lot of this is that my background has nothing to do with this work that I've been involved in. 1989, my PhD's in political science, international relations. And it's another story of how my life took this kind of a direction. But I can't imagine my life now without this work and without my involvement, you know, with an extraordinary group of people in a very vibrant community. Well, actually, I was familiar with the politics, more of the politics in the African-American community in the 70s during my days as a revolutionary, but I wasn't aware of the cultural movements. And so it's actually the politics came and political involvements came earlier on, and when I moved into this work, beginning in 89, I became aware of the cultural dimensions as well. But when I was there in the 70s and doing political work and engaging a lot with Panthers and others, I was unaware of things that were happening just a few blocks away.
Wow. Yeah. And it's actually all in one, the political and the cultural.
No question. In fact, the first time I heard the name Horace Tapscott was when, in the 70s, some of my comrades were saying that, oh, we're going down to hear this great band at this place down near Watts, the IUCC, Emmanuel United Church of Christ. And they kept telling me, come on down. And for some reason, on those Sundays, I always had something else to do, and I never made it. But the way they talk about that band and about Horace Tapscott, I knew that name, and I just had this image in my mind of this underground genius who had turned his back on the commercial world and was struggling to, you know, build his community, etc. And I'd always had that image before I knew anything about the cultural movements and about Horace's music.
Wow. We're fortunate that you were able to work closely with Horace Tapscott and the family and continue this exploration.
I will. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sabir Mateen, for coming in to WBAI to join this discussion.
Glad I got here.
I'm so grateful.
listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guests for this evening were Barbara McCullough, the director of Horace Tapscott musical Griot, which will be screening as part of the African Diaspora International Film Festival on December 2nd, 3 p.m. at the Wilbank Chapel Teachers College at Columbia University. That's 525 West 20th Street, 125 Zankel is the building. We also heard from Steve Iswardi, the author of The Dark Tree, Jazz and the Community Arts in Los Angeles, and multi-instrumentalist Sabir Mateen. Many thanks to all our guests. Hopefully more people will be able to check out Horace Tapscott musical Griot and learn more about Horace Tapscott and the work that he had done in the Los Angeles area. What you're listening to right now is Akirfa, which is actually Africa spelled backwards. This is a Horace Tapscott composition. Horace Tapscott in New York, a 1979 Interplay release. Horace Tapscott on piano, Art Davis on bass, and Roy Haynes on drums. Before that, we heard a portion of the Coltrane medley, Horace Tapscott with the Pan-African People's Orchestra, from the release Flight 17, 1978 Nimbus West Records release. Horace Tapscott on piano, Sabir Mateen on tenor saxophone, John Williams on baritone saxophone, Billy Harris on soprano saxophone, Lester Robinson on trombone, Alan Hines on bass, Roberto Miranda on bass as well, Daoud Woods on percussion, Billy Hinton on drums, Linda Hill on vocals on this recording, and Adele Sebastian on vocals and flute. Before that, we heard The Dark Tree, a Horace Tapscott composition, the Horace Tapscott Quintet from The Giant Is Awakened, the 1969 Flying Dutchman release. Horace Tapscott on piano, Arthur Blythe on alto saxophone, David Bryant on bass, Walter Savage Jr. on bass, and Everett Brown Jr. on drums. Before that, we heard Clarice, a Jesse Sharp's composition, Horace Tapscott with the Pan-African People's Orchestra, also from Flight 17. Horace Tapscott was the conductor on this recording, and Linda Pill held down the piano chair. This is a 1978 Nimbus West Records release. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa coming up next. Sugar in My Bowl will be back on December 10th. We'll probably start our pre-Winter Jazz Festival coverage at that point. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.